Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 23rd. Midland Independent School District says 30,588 students expected by 2027-2028. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD will grow by 9.9% between this year and 2027-2028, resulting in a total student population of 30,588. This was the main takeaway from a 10-year enrollment forecast presented to the board during its regular meeting this week. Board members heard from the Zonda Education that enrollment is up 5.3% to 27,821 this year. Groundwork is underway on roughly 1,200 lots across the district. There are currently 10 active building subdivisions within the district, with 7 future developments in the planning stages. Midland ISD enrollment is expected to reach more than 32,100 by 2032-2033. Upon hearing the presentation of the report, Board President Brian Murray asked MISD staff to make sure the Long Range Planning Committee received the information. The Planning Committee is moving forward with bond conversations. It was the first time that Murray mentioned making sure that the committee had information presented at the meeting. The other time Murray asked information to be shared came after a presentation about the amount of total debt savings MISD achieved by paying off debt early. The next meeting of the Long Range Facility Committee is set for 6 to 8 p.m. on March 2nd at Midland High. The report from Zonda showed elementary schools are growing and was the fastest 6.9% this year. It showed the current enrollment at elementary campuses was 16,284, and that number would increase to 17,628 by 2027-2028. Junior high enrollment was expected to rise from 4,171 to 4,923, and high school enrollment will increase from 7,351 to 8,020. The report contained information about district births, up from 2,453 in 2012 to 2,792 in 2017 to 2,243 in 2021. Kindergarten enrollment in the district has actually decreased from 2,203 in 2018-2019 to 2,160 this year, according to the report. Most of the 23-page report looked at residential building across Midland, including the Vineyard in northwest Midland, the Enclave at Mission, Lone Star Trails 2 in northeast Midland, Grassland West 10th in West Midland, Quail Run in North Midland, Heritage Oaks in northwest Midland, and Mockingbird Ridge in northeast Midland. Those developments alone accounted for 4,838 total or future lots. The report did not show the growth or expected growth of private or out-of-district charter schools inside Midland County. This was the third demographic report Midland ISD has commissioned since 2019. Ahead of the meetings of the smaller Long Range Planning Committee in 2021 and 2022, Midland ISD had Davis Demographics show numbers for student growth. That report called for the district's enrollment to reach 30,430 in 2030, a 20.3% increase. Davis also had performed a demographic study in 2019 that stated the district would grow 28% in 10 years. Mayberry Brothers celebrate life at new funeral home. The story was written by Ben Schaffer. Mayberry Funeral Home wants to turn a sad loss into a celebration of life. The funeral home held a ribbon-cutting ceremony this week for the location at 406 East Illinois Avenue. Brothers Ben and Ed Mayberry want to stay true to their mission of being more than a funeral home. Services include traditional, personalized, and customized funeral accommodations, as well as chapel services and grief care for the deceased family. Ed Mayberry is a pastor at Community Worship Center. Ben said their faith ties into the business. Growing up in Midland, the pair didn't come from great fortune, but learned the value of living by faith early on in their lives. Quote, "We had to understand and know what it truly meant to live by faith," Ben said. "When we did not have, when we couldn't see it in the physical, we knew, hey, it's going to get better. Hang in there. Things are going to work out as they should, and you will be blessed for that." End quote. The pair don't push their religion onto others, but said their trust in God and His plan pushed them into this business. Although deaths of loved ones and friends are troubling, Mayberry Funeral Home wants to work to celebrate the lives of the deceased. Quote, "There," meaning the funerals at Mayberry Funeral Home, "for the most part, celebratory. There's so much taking place all at one time. It's a rejoice and a celebration that they lived a great life and everything they've lived for. They can now receive their reward on the other side," he said. The two brothers have experienced losses of loved ones in their own lives, and while every funeral they attended wasn't all joy and tambourines, personal growth and grief work they've had to go through has shaped who they are today. Ben said the focus of their funeral home and services is to help the community and families who have lost a best friend, significant other, parent, or acquaintance like they have in the past. As kids, the Mayberrys lived near what was Bill Thomas Funeral Home. Bill and the Mayberrys' father, Edward, were best friends. When their father passed away when they were ages 8 and 10 respectively, Thomas allowed Ben and Ed to assist in the preparation of their father for the funeral service. Quote, "For us, it brought such a peace and helped us with grief, and it helped us with the grief process of acceptance and the reality of things and accepting death at such a young age," Ben said. Mayberry Funeral Home is not a grief support center. However, Ben said aftercare services are vital to the business's mission. The brothers don't just want to be in Midlanders' lives when death brings them together. Following the service, they have an aftercare department devoted to reaching out to family members of the deceased to share positive messages, give gifts, and possibly provide direction. Quote, "You don't have to be rolled in here. We want you to truly know that you have people on the journey with you, and our aftercare is very, very important," Ben said. Small Bites. To Die For Food, found at Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe. The story was written by Morgan Taylor Thomas. Adjacent to the Office Depot parking lot sits Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe, a small red and white food truck with modest overhead lettering and a canopy for visitors. Inside, Malcolm Hipponia and second chef R.J. dance around each other 6 days a week, providing Midlanders with the unique taste of Southeast Asia. Hipponia's introduction to cooking started in childhood. Since his mother worked as a university principal, they lived in faculty housing. He recalls the entire house being awake by 5 a.m., ready to munch on her treat of the day. While studying culinary arts in the Philippines, the foodie finished courses focused on bakery, commercial bakery, and bakery management. Next came culinary school in Virginia. After his dad died, Hipponia's family moved to Los Angeles, ultimately leading to a break in his culinary ways. 4 years ago, Eponio's mother fell sick with dementia, and, as the sole caregiver, Malcolm moved the crew one final time to Midland. Here, he started picking up his culinary skills once again, working at a couple establishments, but mostly the Panda Express in Odessa. 5 months of planning, building, gathering materials, and draining savings accounts led to the December 17th opening of Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe. Traditionally, Filipino food takes a while, sometimes days, to prepare. So, when guests started complaining about the wait time for their food, Eponio decided to loosen the reins on tradition and take what he learned from Panda Express's fast-paced environment, even if that meant serving food incomparable to his mother's. The outcome? A massive wok tucked in the corner of his food truck, ready for any dish. The next battle came with introducing Filipino food to the Midland community. Quote, "Filipino food ranks below in Southeast Asia. Why? Because we don't have that distinct dish that people will remember, like pad thai or pho," the chef explained. Nevertheless, Eponio continues to create delicious meals easily liked by all palates. With a growing Filipino presence in West Texas through healthcare and oil, the baker said he feels it's important to educate the community on the uncommon dish. The Midland Filipino can be found at 2326 West Loop 250 from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only bakery goods and noodle dishes are sold on Mondays and Tuesdays. The entire cafe menu is available Wednesdays through Saturdays. To see guest visits to places such as breweries or farmers market, check out their Facebook page. Hot Bites. Quote, "The flavor profiles of Filipino food is greasy, salty, sweet, sour. They're very prominent in our food, but it's not very well appreciated by Westerners because people are very health conscious. They like the veggies of Thailand and Vietnam," Eponio explained. "As someone whose diet mainly consists of plant-based foods, minus my occasional chicken intake, the idea of eating a really greasy meal didn't sound too exciting. Although my diet choice comes from a mix of allergies and a moral dilemma, I understood Heponio's take on Western society. I mean, I don't think I can go one day without seeing some new health fab or get skinny fast scheme on social media. However, after one bite of pancit bihon, I was hooked. The mix of stir-fried rice noodles, chicken, carrots, green cabbage, napa cabbage, bok choy, green beans, and celery easily became one of the best meals I've ever eaten. Topped with green onions and a lemon wedge, guests can also get crushed chicharron. It took me all of about 6 minutes to eat the entire to-go box. The fresh veggies added a crisp and refreshing sentiment to the long and curly noodles. Even though Eponio describes his food as greasy, I'd say the grease was really just the natural oils he used while cooking in the wok. I didn't feel bloated or unwell after eating the large portion, a common occurrence if the food is truly greasy to its core. To see the other 10-plus dishes and wide selection of baked goods available at the Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe, visit its Facebook page. Or better yet, go give them a visit. Overall vibes. I will always advocate for more diversity in the 432. Malcolm Eponio, RJ, and everyone else involved behind the scenes at the Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe grant our community cultural education the best way possible through food. Although they only take up a parking spot worth of space, their four-wheeled kitchen creates some of the most intricate and delectable treats in town through simple and natural ingredients. Lastly, people like Hyponia make Midland more enjoyable to be a part of. Without community members willing to challenge the cuisine status quo and introduced new ideas and flavors to the tall city, well, we'd probably be stuck eating beef patties, and where's the fun in that? Note, although Hipponia prepares his food with a fast food style, do not expect fast food quality. Hipponia has worked hard to perfect his craft. Midland Filipino Bakery and Cafe is not a nationwide chain, but a prime example of a local business owner adapting to his customers' requests.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 23rd, 2023. Community page. What's Up with Midland? By Morgan Taylor Thomas. At the Blue Door. Live music with Royce Corbell, Saturday. At the Destination. Tejano Thursday, March 2nd. Friday Night Live, Jerry Hart and Flatland, March 3rd. State Line Band, March 4th. Karaoke Night, March 9th. Friday Night Live, Whiskey Cult, March 10th. Still at the Destination, Jet Black, Ronnie and the Redwoods, March 11th. Open Mic Night, March 16th. Friday Night Live, Thomas Christian, March 17th. Chase the Night, March 18th. Bring Your Own Blues, March 23rd. At the Horseshoe, Sun County Region Volleyball Association, Friday through Sunday. Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference, March 1st and 2nd. Monster Truck Wars, March 18th. Whiskey Myers, March 31st. At La Hacienda Event Center, Grupo Liberacion y Grupo Brindis, Friday. Riot, March 4th. Queensrick, March 12th. Chase Matthews and Kid G, March 30th. La Zenda Norteña, Los Recoditos, La Zona X y Harry Franco, March 31st. At Micro Market, Low Street Market, March 4th. At Midland AF, Spring Art Crawl, March 3rd. At Midland Community Theater, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Friday and Saturday, March 3rd and 4th. Sense and Sensibility, March 24th through April 15th. At the Museum of the Southwest, Downtown Midland Farmers Market, March 4th and 18th. At the Tailgate, John Stork, March 3rd. Modern Pop-Up Market, March 4th. William Clark Green, Acoustic, March 11th. At Tall City Brewing Company, Crude, Sprayberry Beer Release, Saturday. At the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center, Cheap Trick, February 28th. Live on stage, Brad Laely, jazz saxophonist, Pops and Family Series, March 4th. Hairspray, March 6th. Midland Festival Ballet presents Feel the Energy, March 9th through 11th. John Christ, The Emotional Support Tour, March 12th. Our Planet Live in Concert, March 13th. Yamato, The Drummers of Japan, Hinotori, The Wings of Phoenix, March 16th. Zach Williams, March 17th. Chris D'Elia, March 24th. Maricela La Dama de Hierro, March 25th. High Tide, March 28th. Joanne Shaw Taylor, March 29th. Mike Massimino, UTPB Leadership Institute Distinguished Lecture Series, March 30th. And Chad Prather and the Ragamuffins, March 31st. 3 Things to Do in Midland This Weekend by Morgan Taylor Thomas. Experience an eclectic performance of Mexican music. Join beloved Grupo Liberacion for a night full of award-winning music at La Hacienda Events Center. With an unbeatable discography containing cumbias, norteñas, boleros, rancheras, corridos, bandas, merengue, and more, the Mexican regional group remains one of the most popular international crews. Alongside Grupo Liberacion will be Grammy-winning Grupo Brindis, a pop, cumbia, and banda forging posse, even without a horn section. Tickets can be bought at https://bit.ly/3IXWOSO. Friday. Show starts at 8 p.m. at 12610 State Highway 191 Frontage Road. Learn to model. Join Model House LLC for a runway basics class at JK Dance Center, empowering West Texas to get their foot into the modeling and pageantry industries. Model House hosts an array of events, pageants, and workshops throughout the Permian Basin. At the Runway Basics class, participants will learn about how to fine-tune their runway walk through foot posture, foot placement, facial expressions, body movements, and more. The hour-long sessions cost $25 and can be bought by filling out the Google Doc found at https://bit.ly/3zbowsv. Saturday from 1 to 2 p.m. at 3211 West Wadley, Suite 17. Explore the Tall City. Spring is just around the corner, and Sunday's weather calls for a high of 79 degrees. Start soaking up that vitamin D while you mark an activity or restaurant off your Midland bucket list. Some ideas include $15 axe throwing at Tall City Axe House, grabbing a crepe brunch from Hand Cafe, taking your dog to the park, getting active at the Bush Tennis Center, and pickleball courts, and more. Events and entertainment around the city picks up starting in March, so end February with a little bit of everything. Sunday.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 23rd. Andre Deshaun Mitchell, age 41, of Midland, passed away on February 14th. Andre was born to Deborah Annette Mitchell and Robert Charles Sanders on March 6, 1981, in Midland. He attended school in the Midland School District. Andre was baptized and grew up as a member of the Greater New Hope Baptist Church. Andre was preceded in death by his son, Azarian Jennings, and maternal grandparents, Ruby Giddings, whom he spent so much time with, and his grandfather, Karami Giddings. He is also preceded in death by his paternal grandfather, Alonzo Sanders. Andre is survived by his mother, Deborah Mitchell Akbar, and his stepfather, Hassan Akbar, Father Robert Charles Sanders, his children, Navea, Ishin, Andre Jr., Treshana, Chandre, Dadria, Tachanik, brothers Ashton Akbar, Avery Akbar, Addison Akbar, maternal grandmother Ruby Jones, and several aunts and uncles. The family will receive friends on Thursday, February 23rd, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, 1502 North La Mesa Road, Midland. A funeral service will be held Friday, February 24th, at 11 a.m. at Goodwill Baptist Church, 1001 South Main Street in Midland. Interment will immediately follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens Cemetery at 6800 State Highway 349 in Midland. Funeral arrangements have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Leota Lee V. Harley, age 92, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, February 21st. Visitation will be held on Friday, February 24th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, February 25th, at 2 p.m. at Christ Church Anglican, with burial to follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Leota was born on August 3, 1930, to Lily Maud and John Hugh Vincent in Rogers, New Mexico. She graduated with a Bachelor of Music degree from North Texas College of Denton. In 1958, she married George Foster Harley, Jr., a Midland life insurance agent. She and her husband had twin sons, Steve and Phil. She is survived by her twin sons, Stephen and Philip Harley, and two daughters-in-law, Susie, wife of Stephen, and Jennifer, wife of Philip, and her grandson, Joseph, son of Phil and Jennifer. She is also survived by her brother, Coy Vincent, and her sister-in-law, Ruth Vincent. She is preceded in death by her husband, George Foster Harley, Jr., her parents, Maud and Hugh Vincent, her sister, Eula Dean Downs, and her brother, Kenneth Vincent. The family suggests memorials be donated to Christ Church, 5501 North Midkiff Road in Midland, or Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Esteban U. Bonilla, age 96, passed away Saturday, February 18th. Viewing will be Thursday, February 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral Mass will be Friday, February 24th, at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. Funeral Mass is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com.
Good day. This is Glenn, and I'm going to be reading from the Odessa American edition, Thursday, February 23rd, 2023, front page. City, County discuss interlocal agreements during joint workshop by Royal McGregor. Members of the City of Odessa City Council and Ector County Commissioner's Court spoke about a variety of interlocal agreements during a joint workshop hosted by the Odessa Development Corporation. Though no action was taken on any of the agenda items that were discussed during Tuesday's nearly two-hour workshop, Ector County Judge Dustin Fawcett said he's happy these discussions have already started less than 2 months since he's been sworn into office. "This is not going to be the last time we have this," Fawcett said. "It's the first time that we've had all three entities, to my knowledge. I know that we've had some joint city council and county commissioner sessions in the past, but they haven't been done for several years. This is going to be the first of many, even just this year. Odessa Mayor Javier Jovan said he's glad ODC, City of Odessa, and Ector County left their silos to meet face-to-face. We are laying down a foundation that future board members can use to be able to continue to negotiate, Jovan said. Tuesday's meeting took place at the Salisbury Conference Room located in the Electronics Technology Building on the Odessa College campus. The items that were discussed included interlocal agreements about Odessa Fire Rescue, Ector County Law Enforcement Center, and the Odessa Animal Shelter. There was also a discussion about the Ector County assistance, which has been a sore subject between the city and county since the sales tax district was created several years ago. At the end of the meeting, the group agreed to keep the interlocal agreement about the animal shelter status quo. Ector County can bring animals to the Odessa Animal Shelter as long as they have room for those animals. Ector County Sheriff's Office Captain Tony Bass said the Sheriff's Office is only currently required to quarantine its own animals. The workshop included a 30-minute discussion about the interlocal agreement for Odessa Fire Rescue to do runs in the county. The county currently has a yearly price tag of nearly $800,000 for OFR services. Fawcett asked OFR Interim Fire Chief Jason Cotton about the county exploring private EMS services. Cotton told Fawcett that would be a bad idea. Cotton said, "It's our county and it's our people." Fawcett, after the meeting, said he wanted Cotton's opinion. "I appreciate him giving me his honest opinion," Fawcett said. "I needed to hear that. I knew from previous conversations that it's not apples to apples. I'm not familiar with the private EMS services in Odessa or Ector County or in the region. I do think it's fair to get a cost estimate for what service would cost for that area. That way we would compare the two and see how it looks and is it worth trading off the quality for X amount of dollars. I'm under the opinion that it's hard to put a dollar value on a human life. It's one of those unquantifiable measures. It's about quality. It's not just about saving $1 million. If the citizens aren't getting proper care or proper EMS services that OFR was providing then, did we really do our community a service by saving money?" The Ector County Law Enforcement Center was also discussed during the meeting. The City of Odessa has a yearly price tag of $450,000 for jail services. The yearly budget cost to run the jail is $34.2 million. The workshop attendees also discussed the Ector County Assistance District that has helped Ector County bring about $32 million in just last year, which is the most it has ever collected. The roadblock between the City of Odessa and Ector County is how to split the sales tax money for the parts of the county annexed into used city services. ECISD taking $13 million from fund balance. OA News at OAOA.com. Facing reduced projected revenues due to low attendance, the Ector County ISD Board of Trustees on Tuesday approved a $13 million budget amendment. The funds will come from the district's fund balance. Chief Financial Officer Deborah Otmers said the district will still have a 90-day supply of money with this. But Superintendent Scott Murray said they cannot have the same conversation again next year. Murray said the primary reason for the reduction is lower than expected attendance. Usually attendance is 95%, and that was pre-pandemic. With the pandemic, Murray said attendance last year was a hair over 90%, which was very different than the district had seen before. "We anticipated it would bounce back to 95%. It's now 91.5%. That translates to a $13 million reduction. That's a lot. We were able to do that today because over the last several years, we have maintained a healthy fund balance," Murray said. "We won't be able to do this next year, so we must do a couple of things. One is we have to get our kids attending school," Murray said. He added that he and Otmers will have to have some tough conversations when developing the budget, whether to plan for 91% or 92% attendance. Murray said it is a very real concern that affects raises, for example. Officials noted that when students aren't attending school, learning isn't happening. Murray said attendance issues are pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. The lowest levels of attendance are at Odessa and Permian high schools. Most middle and elementary schools are in the 90s for attendance. Murray said this conversation is being held across the state and nation. The smaller high schools have attendance rates above 95%. Elementary schools are hovering in the low 90s, along with the middle schools, he said. Murray said this is being addressed in a variety of ways: additional attendance clerks, social workers, and homeless specialists. Homeless students under the federal McKinney-Vento Act are families that are doubled up, living in temporary living situations, some students sleeping on someone else's couch, Associate Superintendent of Student and School Support Alicia Siverson said. Chief of Schools Keeley Boyer said there are automated text and phone calls, but also live school staff making calls. Trustee Tammy Hawkins asked if they could report back in a month to see how this is working. Vice President Carol Gregg said there are students who can score 90 without going to class. President Steve Brown said it is an issue of students being engaged. Trustees also discussed offering incentives in collaboration with the chamber to get students to attend school. Boyer said there are some schools that are doing this on their own. Board member Donna Smith said before COVID there was robust community involvement. Brown said he has to give credit to attendance committees on the campuses. He added that they listen and know the students who are frequent flyers and don't come to school. Trustee Dennis Jones said that there are some students that find themselves so far behind they give up, and others who are in the halls socializing and no one is asking them why they aren't in class. Otmer said ECISD will have a bit of a clearer picture next month in predicting the fund balance. There's a lot still to happen, she said. The board also approved the 2023-24 academic calendar. New teachers begin July 31st, and all teachers start August 2nd. Associate Superintendent of Curriculum and Instruction Lilia Nanez said, it includes transition periods for 6th and 9th grade students that was started and was successful during COVID. Students and teachers get a full week for Thanksgiving. Teachers and students have 2 weeks at Christmas. The difference is that the weeks are split. It doesn't go Monday through Friday. Nanya said the last day of school is a Tuesday, and then they return January 3rd for professional development. She said weeks like this are very common in Texas. A professional learning day, January 3rd, helps teachers gear up for spring semester, Nanya said. The academic year ends before Memorial Day. Graduations will be completed by Friday night, so everyone will have the full three-day weekend. Summer learning for pre-K 5th grade and high school goes through July 17th, and middle school runs through June 27th. The calendar chosen received over 200 comments provided on Facebook, over 800 from parents, and over 400 from staff members. Students will be served for 180 days, and there are 6 half days for early release with a half day for professional development. Odessa Collegiate Academy and OCTECHS are aligned to the Odessa College calendar. The board also approved the pilot project for virtual instructional coaching at a cost of $30,000. After an executive session, the board approved contract renewals for administrators, pay grades 6 to 11. Local news roundup. Boyfriend accused of beating girlfriend. A 23-year-old Odessa man was arrested Saturday after his girlfriend told officers he pointed a loaded gun at her head during an argument in which he also beat and kicked her. According to an Odessa Police Department report, a 22-year-old woman said Alex Nathan Morales punched her in the face multiple times shortly before midnight Saturday, causing her to fall. Once she was on the ground, the woman said Morales repeatedly kicked her in the torso before grabbing a gun, pointing it at her head, and firing it into the air, the report stated. Officers saw Morales running away from the scene in the 6100 block of East Highway 80 and later found him near Bainbridge Drive and Dennis Lane, the report stated. Morales told officers he took the firearm from his girlfriend and ran away with it, according to the report. Morales, who was convicted of burglary in March, was arrested on suspicion of unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, discharging a firearm within certain municipalities, and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Morales remained in the Ector County Jail Wednesday on surety bonds totaling $66,500. Odessan accused in ag assault. A 32-year-old Midland man is facing 2 felony charges following a bar fight early Saturday morning. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers learned of a disturbance at La Playa on East 8th Street around 2:15 a.m. Saturday, and when they arrived, witnesses told them a 28-year-old man had been hit in the face with a beer bottle, causing a cut above one of his eyebrows. Officers arrested Francisco Javier Garcia Chavez, and while searching him, discovered 1.5 grams of cocaine in a folded dollar bill in his pocket, the report stated. Chavez was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and possession of a controlled substance. The assault charge is punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison, and the drug charge carries a 2 to 10-year prison term. Chavez remained in the Ector County Jail Wednesday on surety bonds totaling $40,000 in an immigration and customs enforcement hold. OPD nabs cocaine in undercover op. An Odessa man was arrested and more than 300 grams of cocaine were seized Tuesday following an undercover operation by the Odessa Police Department. According to an OPD report, officers with the Intelligence Division received information Brandon Lee Alvarado, 24, was selling cocaine and made arrangements to meet at a store on West Clements Avenue to purchase drugs from him. Officers watched Alvarado go to his house on Oak Avenue, go inside for a short time, and then drive to the Clements Avenue store, the report stated. Because he had a history of evading local police and resisting arrest, the officers stopped Alvarado with their weapons drawn, the report stated. Officers found 46 grams of cocaine in 5 individual baggies in Alvarado's Ford Expedition and another 268.3 grams of cocaine in his house, according to the report. They also found baggies, a digital scale, and a .22 caliber rifle with a sawed-off barrel. Alvarado was arrested on suspicion of manufacturing, delivery of a controlled substance, a first-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison, and possession of a prohibited weapon, a third-degree felony punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. Alvarado remains in the Ector County Jail on surety bonds totaling $90,000 and a U.S. Marshal's hold. According to OPD and jail records, Alvarado was arrested back in September after officers found him with 5.34 grams of cocaine in individual baggies after he tried to start a fight inside the Rocks nightclub on East University Boulevard. He was indicted on a possession of a controlled substance charge in that case January 24th. couple accused of leaving firearm unsecured. A West Texas couple was arrested Friday, 5 months after a 12-year-old boy shot another teenager with a .22-caliber rifle authorities said they left unsecured. According to an Ector County Sheriff's report, the 12-year-old boy and a 13-year-old friend were playing video games on September 18th in the 6800 block of West 26th Street when the younger boy accidentally discharged a rifle which had been loaded and left unsecured. According to an arrest warrant issued February 15th, the older boy was struck in the back by a bullet and remained hospitalized in a Lubbock hospital for more than a month. He still requires physical therapy. Paul Wayne Palmer Jr., 42, and Ashley Page Palmer, 36, were arrested February 17th on suspicion of making a firearm accessible to a child, a misdemeanor. They were released from the Ector County Jail the same day after posting bonds of $1,500 each. UTPB hosts Entrepreneurial Challenge Check Presentation. UT Permian Basin would like to invite you to the Midland Entrepreneurial Challenge Check Presentation Ceremony on Monday. The check presentations will begin at 7:45 p.m. at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center in the Ray Greathouse Recital Hall. The Midland Entrepreneurial Challenge is a six-month business boot camp competition which began in September of 2022 and gives entrepreneurs a unique, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity at free funding for their startup or to grow their existing business. This year, MEC had over 100 businesses sign up to attend orientation and 52 registered to compete in the challenge. After three rounds of competition, the final four businesses were recently selected to receive their share of the $500,000 prize money. After each round of competition, a number of participants were eliminated, leaving the final eight businesses to pitch to the judges. MEC was privileged to have four prominent businessmen and women in the community volunteer their time to judge the competition. The final four businesses who have been selected to receive the prize money will be presented with checks by the Midland Development Corporation Board Chairman Chase Gardaff and John Norman, Midland City Council District 2 Mayor Pro Tempore. Additional Midland Development Corporation Board and City Council members will also be in attendance. The Midland Entrepreneurial Challenge will have a direct and positive economic impact for Midland by creating jobs and bringing revenue into the city. This year's winners are Toya's Precious Jewels, $150,000, Central Bites, $150,000, The Tailgate, $100,000, Midland Athletic Company, $100,000, total of $500,000. OC Academy competing on state level, from the OA News at OAOA.com. A delegation from Odessa Collegiate Academy will be heading to state competition in the academic decathlon this weekend in San Antonio. Coach Michael Crowder will be taking 14 people, including 9 competitors, student coaches, and alternates to the Thomas E. Mosley Texas Academic Decathlon State Meet to compete for a chance at nationals. The meet runs today, February 23rd to February 25th. Students are chosen for the team through several contests. We go through a series of competitions where the kids compete against other people in the district. I look at the scores and I look at how the kids are performing in areas like speech and essay. Then I kind of look at, okay, who are my best scorers? Who has the most growth potential, who's been showing the most improvement, and then I get together with my other coaches and we pick them from there, Crowder said. He added that he has several assistant coaches, with the main one being Lydia Roundtree. To get to state, they won the Region 1 Texas Academic Decathlon Region Meet in Keller from January 27th to January 28th. George H.W. Bush took second place in small schools, Permian High School got fourth place in large schools, and Odessa High School got sixth place in large schools. Kristen Vesely, Director of Advanced Academic Services, said in an email that NTO earned a space at the Texas Scholarship State Meet to compete for scholarships February 23rd to the 25th. PHS and OHS did not advance this year, she wrote. There are two state meets. They're going to the Thomas Mosley State Championship. If they do well there, there's a possibility they could continue to nationals. There are 7 subjects, so students compete in art, economics, music, math, social science, science, and literature. They each have to take an exam in that. Then they have to write an essay. We did that part of the competition a few weeks ago. They have to give a speech, then they have to participate in an interview, Crowder said. He added that he is super proud of his students. Every time there's been something in front of them, or I've said, okay, we need to get this much better in order to get past this next level, they've stepped up and been able to do it for us, Crowder said. He started coaching last year, and they had a team for a couple years before. When I picked it up last year, it was very new to me. It sometimes felt like I was just running around trying to stay one step ahead of everything that needed to be done, Crowder said. They were hoping to do the best they could and chalk it up to a learning year. Well, then we won the Frisco State Championship for small schools, which is the second-tier state championship. When we won that, all of a sudden it kicked over and it was like, hey, wait a minute, we can do this. We are as smart as the other kids on this stage. We can win these things, Crowder said. As soon as they knew what the subject was going to be for the next year, they started working. We got our study materials in late July, and they've been just chipping away at it ever since, Crowder said. The breakdown of the team is based on how well the students do in school. You have what's called an honors category for your students that have a 3.8 GPA or higher. You have a scholastic category that covers from 3.2 GPA up to 3.79. And then you have a varsity category that goes from 0 up to 3.19. We have a couple of sophomores, we have some juniors, and then we have five seniors, he said. Crowder has an octathlon team of freshmen and sophomores that he's been working with this year, so they are prepared to step in and compete next year for OCA. Shelby Clark, an 18-year-old senior, joined the decathlon team last year. She said she's been making pretty gradual improvement over the years and is proud of how she did, but that she can do better. For the state competition, Clark said she thinks she'll do well. I've been spending the past couple of weeks preparing, so I'm pretty confident with how I'll do, Clark said. Clark, like the other students, said this experience will help her in life. Some said it has helped them talk to adults in a formal way, helped with test-taking and study skills. This has taught me a lot of self-discipline as well. I've been able to improve my studying skills, so I think that'll carry over outside of the curriculum and outside of high school, Clark said. Skyley Ibarra, a 15-year-old sophomore, said this is her first year in decathlon. She said her coach pushed her to get involved because he saw her potential. I thought it was really cool to be a team with everybody and just feel the support, Ibarra said. She adds that she feels good about the group's chances at state. If we all put in the work and just work really hard, we can make it to nationals, Ibarra said. Nadine Marcello, an 18-year-old senior, has been in academic decathlon since her sophomore year. At the time, it was the only big club in our school, so I decided I wanted to be more involved and decided to try it out, Marcello said. At first, she didn't really take it seriously because as a sophomore, there were upperclassmen she thought would carry the team. But starting last year, I started taking the leadership role of being the upperclassman myself, so I started taking it more seriously. And as I did that, I realized that we had a greater potential once everyone really gets into it, Marcello said. Seeing how everyone has studied, she feels they have a better chance of winning state. Not only have we strategized every step of the way, but we are putting in the work to reach our goal, Marcello added. Race Wright, a 17-year-old junior, has been on the decathlon team since sophomore year. What did it for him was a jar of Jolly Ranchers he got in a raffle at the orientation. Local news roundup. Boyfriend accused of beating girlfriend. A 23-year-old Odessa man was arrested Saturday after his girlfriend told officers he pointed a loaded gun at her head during an argument in which he also beat and kicked her. According to an Odessa Police Department report, a 22-year-old woman said Alex Nathan Morales punched her in the face multiple times shortly before midnight Saturday, causing her to fall. Once she was on the ground, the woman said Morales repeatedly kicked her in the torso before grabbing a gun, pointing at her head, and firing it into the air, the report stated. Officers saw Morales running away from the scene in the 6100 block of East Highway 80 and later found him near Bainbridge Drive and Dennis Lane, the report stated. Morales told officers he took the firearm from his girlfriend and ran away with it, according to the report. Morales, who was convicted of burglary in March, was arrested on suspicion of unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, discharging a firearm within certain municipalities, and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Morales remained in the Ector County Jail Wednesday on surety bonds totaling $66,500. Odessan accused in ag assault. A 32-year-old Midland man is facing two felony charges following a bar fight early Saturday morning. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers learned of a disturbance at La Playa on East 8th Street around 2:15 a.m. Saturday, and when they arrived, witnesses told them a 28-year-old man had been hit in the face with a beer bottle, causing a cut above one of his eyebrows. Officers arrested Francisco Javier Garcia Chavez, and while searching him, discovered 1.5 grams of cocaine in a folded dollar bill in his pocket, the report stated. Chavez was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and possession of a controlled substance. The assault charge is punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison, and the drug charge carries a 2 to 10-year prison term. Chavez remained in the Ector County Jail Wednesday on surety bonds totaling $40,000 in an immigration and customs enforcement hold. OPD nabs cocaine in undercover op. An Odessa man was arrested and more than 300 grams of cocaine were seized Tuesday following an undercover operation by the Odessa Police Department. According to an OPD report, officers with the Intelligence Division received information Brandon Lee Alvarado, 24, was selling cocaine and made arrangements to meet at a store on West Clements Avenue to purchase drugs from him. Officers watched Alvarado go to his house on Oak Avenue, go inside for a short time, and then drive to the Clements Avenue store, the report stated. Because he had a history of evading local police and resisting arrest, the officers stopped Alvarado with their weapons drawn, the report stated. Officers found 46 grams of cocaine in five individual baggies in Alvarado's Ford Expedition and another 268.3 grams of cocaine in his house, according to the report. They also found baggies, a digital scale, and a .22 caliber rifle with a sawed-off barrel. Alvarado was arrested on suspicion of manufacturing, delivery of a controlled substance, a first-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison, and possession of a prohibited weapon, a third-degree felony punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. Alvarado remains in Ector County Jail on surety bonds totaling $90,000 and a U.S. Marshals hold. According to OPD and jail records, Alvarado was arrested back in September after officers found him with 5.34 grams of cocaine in individual baggies after he tried to start a fight inside the Rocks nightclub on East University Boulevard. He was indicted on a possession of a controlled substance charge in that case January 24th. Couple accused of leaving firearm unsecured. A West Texas couple was arrested Friday, 5 months after a 12-year-old boy shot another teenager with a .22-caliber rifle authorities said they left unsecured. According to an Ector County Sheriff's report, the 12-year-old boy and a 13-year-old friend were playing video games on September 18th in the 6800 block of West 26th Street when the younger boy accidentally discharged a rifle which had been loaded and left unsecured. According to an arrest warrant issued February 15th, the older boy was struck in the back by a bullet and remained hospitalized in a Lubbock hospital for more than a month. He still requires physical therapy. Paul Wayne Palmer, Jr., 42, and Ashley Page Palmer, 36, were arrested February 17th on suspicion of making a firearm accessible to a child, a misdemeanor. They were released from the Ector County Jail the same day after posting bonds of $1,500 each. Obituaries for Thursday, February 23rd, 2023. Cheryl Ann Criswell Turley, Park City, Kansas. Cheryl Ann Turley, 72, was born Cheryl Ann Criswell in Ellsworth, Kansas, on December 25th, 1950, and passed away in her Park City, Kansas home with her daughter by her side on February 17th, 2023. She was a 1969 graduate of Medicine Lodge High School and attended Sault City Business College from 1969 to 1971. She is preceded in death by her parents, Daryl Leroy Criswell, 1920 to 1997, and her cherished mother, Edith May McCoy Criswell, 1926 to 2016. She will be forever held in beautiful memory by her three beloved children, whom she dedicated and gave all of her life and her love to: Jason Turley of Colwich, Kansas; Tyson Turley of Dighton, Kansas; Adam and Sharina Turley Schiffelbein of Park City, Kansas. Her precious grandchildren, Jessica Jo Turley Carter of Wichita, Kansas; Ashley Marie Turley Thornburg of Great Bend, Kansas; Taylor Nicole Turley Berry of Wichita, Kansas; Terrence J. Turley of Bismarck, North Dakota; Logan Cordell Turley of Dighton, Kansas. One great-grandchild, Jackson Matthew Carter, born February 20th, 2022, as well as her dear sisters, whom she loves so much, very all throughout her life: Doug and Diane White Simpson of San Antonio, Texas; Tom and Carolyn Criswell West of Scott City, Kansas; and Mary Criswell Comba of Scott City, Kansas. Many nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. All are welcome to attend. Graveside services will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, February 25th, 2023, in the Calvary Cemetery of Leoville, Kansas, with Pastor Darren Hammond officiating. Visitation will be held on Friday, February 24th, 2023, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Garnand Funeral Home in Garden City, Kansas. Memorial contributions are suggested to the Cheryl Turley Memorial Fund in care of Garnand Funeral Home. The family will gather at the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church prior to the service. Please join the family for a meal and time of fellowship following the service, also in the basement of the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Leoville, Kansas, 412 North 7th Street, Garden City, Kansas, 67846, phone number 620-276-3219. Obituary, Doris Carter Maddox Willis, Fort Worth, Texas. Doris was born on October 21st, 1932, to Ellis Maddox and Flora Goforth Maddox, and went to be with the Lord on February 20th, 2023. Born in rural Mississippi, her childhood was spent playing with her sisters and many cousins. In 1954, she graduated from Alcorn High School and moved to Pecos, Texas. In 1987, she caught the eye of John Willis, a handsome widower at her church. On August 29th, 1987, they married, adding two daughters, Patty Willis Melton and Nancy Willis O'Meara Crinick, to her folks to love. Those were wonderful days for Doris. John's quiet, loving manner and abiding faith in God were lights in her life. Their marriage flourished until John's death in January 2006. Doris continued her life in Odessa, where she was a women's Sunday school teacher, played bunco with her sisters and friends, joined a book club, bought a darling Shih Tzu buddy, and hosted parties for nieces, nephews, her sisters, and friends. In 2017, her memory began to decline, so she moved to Fort Worth to be close to her daughter, Devon. In her last days, she lived at Colonial Guard Memory Care. Even as her memory failed, her lifelong habit of gratitude and courtesy to others never left her. We are grateful for LaShonda, Katrina, Caitlin, Judy, Amanda, Candace, Bay, Stephanie, and all the staff who treated Miss Doris with love and respect. She is survived by 4 daughters, 3 sons-in-law, 7 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, her sister, 1 nephew, 3 nieces, and great-nephews and nieces. The service will be held on Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 for visitation. Service at 10 at Crescent Park Baptist Church. Memorials to Crescent Park Baptist Church and rockride.org, Georgetown. Dr. Keith Roach, column. Mesa, calculator, and heart disease. Dear Dr. Roach, as a 73-year-old woman, I had a coronary calcium scan done when my new primary care physician wanted me to start on a statin. He discouraged me from having the scan done, saying it wouldn't change his recommendation. I had tried 3 statins when I was in my 50s, and all of them caused muscle pain. I stopped each of them with my former doctor's knowledge. My lipid panel showed that my total cholesterol was 263, HDL was 73, LDL was 150, triglycerides were 160, and ratio was 3.6. My coronary calcium scan showed a score of 128. My total of 128 is in the range of 100 to 400 and put me in the 60th percentile and at moderate to near future probability for a myocardial infarction. Please explain what that means and how it is possible that someone with a score of 128 can be in the same risk category as someone with a score of 399. The report seems serious, but with my history, I'm not sure I want to take a statin again. VV. Answer. The coronary calcium score provides additional information about a person's risk for developing a heart attack or dying of heart disease. Risk is usually given as a percentage of people who will have an event in the next 10 years. There are many calculators to give a clinician and patient an estimate of risk, but none of the calculators are perfect. They use a subset of all the information available to provide a starting point, but a clinician uses additional information to adjust the risk provided by the calculator. The MESA calculator takes into account a person's coronary calcium score as well as some other traditional risk factors such as cholesterol, blood pressure, and family history. With the information you gave me, the calculator estimates your risk of a bad outcome in the next 10 years is 12.1%. This calculator uses your exact number and doesn't put people into categories the way your report did. If you had a calcium score of 399, for example, your 10-year risk would have been 16.2%. The positive family history changed your risk, too. It would have been 8.9% if you had no family history of heart attack. At the level of 12.1%, the clear recommendation would be to take a statin. A statin would be expected to reduce your 10-year risk from 12.1% to roughly 9.7%. Unfortunately, you have had bad reactions to statins, and the decision to try a different one is up to you. There is certainly a benefit, but it is not a huge benefit. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach.
Here is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 23rd. Divorced couples' finances have changed since parting. Dear Abby, I divorced my husband of 12 years. We were together for 16. We had a 4-year-old at the time we separated. To avoid possible loss of the 401k or to have to pay him alimony, I didn't ask him for child support. I knew he wasn't able to afford it at the time. He has since gotten a good job, but hasn't offered to financially support his daughter. My new fiancé has no respect for him because of this. I have let it go to keep the peace so we can co-parent, and my now 9-year-old daughter won't have to see what is going on. This is becoming a problem on holidays because we've always celebrated with her together. She has grown to love that we do this for her. However, my fiancé doesn't want to be a part of those special moments. He doesn't think my daughter would mind, and he doesn't want to risk losing his cool in front of her. This is putting a strain on our relationship. Is it wrong of me to want him to fake it so we can all get along? Or is he wrong to make other plans to avoid these situations? Signed, For Her Sake in Georgia. Dear For Her Sake, because your ex-husband's employment circumstances have improved since the divorce, have a calm, adult conversation with him. Many exes would not have been as understanding as you have been. Because he can now afford it, he should share in the cost of raising his daughter. If you can reach an agreement, have an attorney draw up a document in writing. However, if he isn't willing to step up, contact a lawyer who specializes in family law to discuss what your next steps should be. Also, with your new engagement, Your personal circumstances have changed. Your fiancé should not be compelled to interact with your ex if it makes him uncomfortable. Dear Abby, my husband passed away a year ago from a long ordeal with Alzheimer's. Before he died, I invited my soon-to-be retired sister to come live with me. We had been close throughout our lives, and I thought it would be good for both of us. My problem is, I have casually dated several men since my husband's death. I have welcomed the companionship and the affection I had been missing long before my husband passed. My sister, who is somewhat reclusive, has expressed that I shouldn't be doing this and has gone so far as to say that she doesn't want to live in a whorehouse. She also makes derogatory comments about any gentleman I have introduced her to. I think that, at my age, I should be able to do what I wish in my own home. But because of how she reacts, I no longer have any gentlemen or women friends over because all she does is denigrate all of them. I'm tired of walking on eggshells around her. Are there any options other than asking her to move? Signed, Living as I Want in Washington. Dear Living, no, there aren't. Your sister should not be ruling your social life. The sooner you help her find another place to live, the healthier it will be for both of you. Start now.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.